Hello, welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, author Brandon Taylor joins us to discuss his highly praised debut novel, Real Life. It's a powerful work of fiction that has been described as a brooding campus novel in The New Yorker and a blistering coming-of-age story in O, Oprah Magazine. Real Life is loosely based on Taylor's own experience as a queer Black graduate student navigating a predominantly white Midwestern campus. In his book, over the course of one weekend, readers follow the protagonist Wallace and his friends as they navigate complex relationships, intimacy, desire, violence, trauma, and racism, and struggle with the question, what is real life? Real Life was shortlisted for this year's prestigious Booker Prize and was named a Best Book of the Year by the New York Times, Washington Post, and NPR. And we recently learned it will be made into a movie next year. Oh, I don't know if it's next year, but anyway. Brandon Taylor's short stories have appeared in many publications, including American Short Fiction, The New Yorker Online, and The Literary Review. Taylor is the senior editor of Electric Literature's Recommended Reading and a staff writer at LitHub. He has graduate degrees from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the Iowa Writers' Workshop, where he was an Iowa Arts Fellow. Brandon Taylor, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a crazy year, 2020, for pretty much everybody, but you have had a pretty amazing year. How's it felt to publish your first novel and have it shortlisted for the Booker Prize and named a Best Book of the Year by several prominent publications?
Surreal and strange. I mean, I think that, you know, just the very act of publishing is a kind of self-estranging process. Like, it's a very, like, even in the sort of best of times and best of context, it's just like a weird exercise and self-abasement in some cases. And so, you know, your debut novels by and large don't get any attention at all. And so I had sort of prepared for that. I'd prepared for this book to disappear. And the fact that it kind of didn't was a shock, I think, first and primarily a shock to me. But it's just been really humbling and really moving that this book is sort of, that it seems to have found its audience and its people. And it's been, yeah, the best part of a very strange and difficult year.
It's definitely speaking to a moment for sure. Real Life has also been picked up for the big screen. So congratulations on that. And you're adapting the screenplay, right?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
How's that going?
Well, I have not yet started, but I'm excited to get started. It's kind of special because early on, the first queer texts I came to were movies and films, and, you know, like watching Shelter, like a gay movie from like the mid-2000s and like 10 parts on YouTube and that sort of thing. And so it feels really special to imagine that something that I had written is going to maybe be someone else's entree into queer text. It's, you know, it's exciting and but also really terrifying.
Do you have any idea how long the movie making process is? When could we expect it in the theaters?
Well, I mean, it's a long and winding road, and we have only just begun to have like the real conversations about it. And so I know nothing, but I hope more soon.
Okay, fantastic. So let's dive into the book. Brandon, if you would please first, without giving too much away, give us a brief synopsis and then, you know, what's the book about essentially, and then read a passage from the opening pages of Real Life.
Certainly. So Real Life is a novel about a queer Black man, Wallace, who is a doctoral student in biochemistry, and he spent the entire summer breeding nematodes. And the novel opens on one of those idyllic Midwestern late summer Fridays when he's in lab, like always, and he discovers that his research project has been compromised, either through his own carelessness or sabotage. He isn't sure which at the moment. And in a moment of just frustration, he decides he's going to go to the lake to see his friends for the first time in quite a number of years. And that decision sets into motion a series of, you know, reckonings and reevaluations as he has to sort of figure out, you know, why grad school? Why am I still here? Do these people that I claim as my friends even know me? Do I know them? Do we love each other? Like, what is this life I have chosen for myself? As he has to, you know, make the choice of like what he's going to do for the rest of his life. And to me, it's, you know, it's a novel about being 25, 26, and that realization that I think many people have where like, oh, childhood is over. I have to start being the person I'm going to be And I've got to do that on my own terms. So what are those terms and what do I want? That's, you know, that's the way I think of it. Just one of those novels of a young person having to figure out what they want their life to look like.
Okay. So if you could read a section for us, that'd be great.
Yeah, I'd love to. So this section is at the very, very beginning of the book. And it's the moment where Wallace has gone to the lake and he's looking for his friends there. There, among the burgundy wooden tables nearest the lake, he saw the four of them. Or no, more specifically, he saw Miller, who was extraordinarily tall, the easiest to spot, then Ingva and Cole, who were merely tall, and then Vincent, who just scraped under the bar of average height. Miller, Ingva, and Cole looked like a trio of pale, upright deer, like they belonged to their own particular species, and you could be forgiven if you were in a hurry for thinking them related. Like Wallace and their other friends, they had all come to this Midwestern city to pursue graduate studies in biochemistry. Their class had been the first small one in quite some time, and the first in more than three decades to include a Black person. In his less generous moments, Wallace thought these two things related, that a narrowing, a reduction in the number of applicants, had made his admission possible.
Thank you. So real life has been identified as being semi-autobiographical. Wallace is a gay Black man from the South, as you are, I believe. So how much of Wallace is you?
I think that if you sort of take us like a big step back and you look at both of our lives, they're very similar. Like, I am from the South. I went to the Midwest to study biochemistry. I did that for a number of years. And Wallace left the South for very similar reasons. And, you know, the way that I think about Wallace is like, he is me. If I hadn't, you know, found a group of friends who loved me and uplifted me, and if I hadn't done therapy, you know, I sort of gave Wallace all of my unalloyed baggage, all of the sort of messiness and the messy questions that obsess me. Like, you know, is it possible to know other people? Is it possible to survive your traumatic past? Is it possible to make connections with people across class and race and sexuality? Like, all of those questions which have informed my own life, I sort of took all of those questions out of my life and moved them into fiction. And so, you know, the kind of broad contours of our life are very similar. But I also think that Wallace and I are quite different. Like, I would never say the things that Wallace says at a dinner party, for example. Like, I just have more social tact than Wallace does. And you know, like, my dad is still alive. Wallace's father is dead. You find that out in the first line. Like, so biographical, the nitty gritty details are quite different, but the kind of big morphological features of our lives are quite similar.
So what was your experience like in graduate school as a science, working in some field of science? I think you said biochemistry.
Yeah.
Biochemistry. Thank you.
I mean, it was, you know, grad school is where I kind of became an adult. Of course, I was like in my 20s when I went to grad school, but I was very naive. I was fresh from college. All I knew was that I wanted to leave the South and I wanted to get away from my family. And I just wanted to be on my own terms for the first time in my life. And, you know, grad school is like where I became an adult. And so I had all the sort of the usual difficulties of coming of age, like living in a city far from home independently with no help from home. Like, how do you survive? Like, all of those questions I had to sort through, on top of just the difficulty of a graduate program, particularly like a doctorate program in something like biochemistry, where I was studying stem cell biology. And, you know, so I had to figure out, like, you know, the shift from pedagogical education, like as like a sort of K through 12 or even through college, the shift from that to the training that you have to undergo in order to be able to produce new knowledge, like that was just so difficult. That was so hard. And like, that part is hard for everybody. But couple that with being, you know, among white people who have never seen a Black person before, and among people who considered themselves like very progressive and very kind, and they were progressive and kind, but they also had these biases that they just didn't know how to work through. And so it was incredibly difficult because I was having to do all of that at the same time. And I felt in many ways that I wasn't prepared for it. Like, it was just so brutal. It was a difficult time, but it was also a time of, you know, great love. And I learned a lot about being a grown up, and I met a lot of really wonderful people, and I got to live in a beautiful city on three lakes. Like, it was it was one of the most important periods of my life, but it was also brutal and bruising and awful in many ways.
Yeah, well, okay, I can relate. I went to graduate school in Northwestern for journalism, so I relate to like being by the lake, and I wasn't faced with racial oppression, but I was, this is 30 years ago, and I was coming to terms with my sexuality and not figuring that out, and like being confused and upset, you know. And then meanwhile, I had all this schoolwork to do, and like, you know, in a short amount of time, it was a very condensed program.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly difficult. Like, I think that's one of the things that makes grad school so hard is like, there's the whole academic side of it, and then there's the whole like coming of age as a conscious person. Like, that is so much harder than the movies make it seem. Like, it's so hard to figure out, who am I? What am I? I mean, it's really, you like start questioning your identity in all these different ways. And it's not easy. Yeah.
So back to a little bit about your experience in graduate school. In the book, Wallace has this experiment he's been working on, a project he's been working on, that we find out, I don't think I'm giving too much away to say that apparently it's been sabotaged by someone. Was the competitiveness in your grad school experience that intense that someone might have been, you know, messing with your projects? Or is that something you've seen happen to other people?
Yeah, I mean, my cohort wasn't like that. Like, my cohort of like, I think I had my class was very big. I think there were 20 something of us. And it wasn't that competitive. We weren't like that with each other. And my lab wasn't like that either. My lab, you know, it had its difficulties, but by and large, it was a really supportive environment in some ways, in other ways, not so much. So like that kind of competitiveness wasn't a part of my personal grad experience, but it was certainly something I saw. And certainly there were moments when, you know, someone would be talking about their first author publication in Cell, and you would see other people's eyes go cold as they were hearing the good news. And so it's certainly, I think it's a part of, you know, it's a part of academic culture the same way it's a part of any kind of culture where you have people competing over finite resources. But the competitiveness wasn't a part of my own experience directly. What I did experience, though, was a certain kind of like, not competitiveness, but undercutting. Like, there was a kind of undercutting that I experienced from some people in my lab, especially. And it seemed to be not motivated by, like, they, like, when I think of competitiveness, I think of people feeling threatened by another person's ascendancy. And that didn't feel like what was happening. It felt like it was coming from some other source of malicious, like, intent, some other weird manifestation of someone else's insecurity.
So I think that leads us into another section of the book that you're going to read. You have Wallace. See, I did it. I did it like I said I would. Wallace has a lab, not partner, I shouldn't say, but she shares the bench with him, I guess, the other side of the bench. I'm spacing on her name right now. But anyway, they have this altercation, and the head of the lab, Simone, the head researcher, I guess, she's got some issues.
Yeah, Simone's got some problems. Yeah, I'm going to read from the section that's kind of a prelude to that, where Wallace and Dana, who's the not very great lab person, have had kind of a messy situation where Wallace has like tried to help her, and she did not respond to that very well. And so I'm going to read the fallout from that. He watched her for the rest of that day. He was in his second year then, she her first. They were young and still finding their way. What did Wallace know? After all, he'd always felt a little uneasy in lab, a little uncertain, and he thought everyone felt that way, insecure, unwilling to ask for help because it meant bearing your belly. He had wanted to say something to her about that, that he knew it could be scary to say you didn't know something, but that people wanted to help mostly. He wanted to be a good lab mate, a supportive person, but instead Dana had drawn a thick, dark line between the two of them. He was one way, she was another, she was gifted, he was not. But at the end of that day, Dana stood staring at her columns, wondering what had gone wrong. She stood there staring at the printout of the purity readings, which made no sense, of course. The spec reading said that there was no protein at all in the tube, but she couldn't understand why. Hadn't she followed the directions? Simone stood at the end of her bench looking at the data with her. She waved Wallace over, and he went shyly. Night had been falling in a smooth, dark veil beyond the window. He saw all three of them reflected there in the light of the lab. "Do you know something about this, Wallace?" Simone asked. "About what?" "Dana's results. She says you mixed up the kits." Wallace frowned and shook his head. "No, I think Dana used the wrong one." Simone turned the box around and pointed, and Wallace saw there in the neat print that the kit was the protein one. He felt an inky, slippery feeling inside.
And that comes after he had, earlier before the part you read, he had been trying to tell Dana that, hey, I think you're using the wrong kit. But she was like, "Yeah, I know what I'm doing. Don't bug me."
Yeah.
And then so then later there's this scene where she's accusing him of misogyny and says something like to the effect that, you know, you're gay and you're black and you can walk around as if you're just God's gift or whatever.
Yeah.
What's that about? Why is that important for that to be in her character?
Yeah. I mean, I really struggled with that part of the book. What I wanted was for Dana's frustration and like her outburst to come from a place of like real, like something that she genuinely believes, you know, and of course Wallace doesn't think that he's a misogynist, like, but I think many gay men don't want to believe that they are even capable of misogyny, but of course, like, that's impossible. Like, every person is capable of everything. And so when writing Dana, I wanted her to have, like, you know, the benefit of her own convictions. Like, when she calls him a misogynist, she really believes it. She's not just making that up. She thinks it is. Even though Wallace is like, "But I haven't done anything to you. How could you believe that?" So the reader is kind of allied with Wallace, but Dana is coming from her own experience, flawed though it may be. But I do think that that is a part of the friction you get with queer men and women, is that there's a lot of solidarity there, but I do think that sometimes we forget that within certain hierarchies we have power over people who might in other hierarchies have power over us. And that's something that I've experienced as a queer black man in the context of like white women. Like, in many ways I'm like, yes, I understand that I'm a man and that, you know, I have privileges that you don't have, but also you have privileges that I don't have. And I think that we need to just be kind and considerate to each other. Like, we need to sort of find a way to build actual solidarity. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that part of the book was just trying to honor like a really complicated reality where you have people who exist in various hierarchies to each other simultaneously.
Yeah, and just shortly after that discussion between the two of them, Wallace is in a situation, I don't remember the details exactly, but where he is saying like, "Hey, you know, you don't get to decide what racism is," just like Dana is saying, "You don't get to define misogyny."
Totally.
You're listening to Out of the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen, speaking with Brandon Taylor, the acclaimed author of Real Life, which was shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize and named a best book of the year by the New York Times, Washington Post, and NPR. So that kind of brings you to a question. How do homophobia and racism both affect Wallace's life and perhaps by extension yours?
You know, I think that in the context of Wallace's life, he's got to negotiate like these various societal forces, and he doesn't get to, you know, he doesn't get to take a break from one just because he's experiencing the other. Like, he doesn't get to be like, "Okay, I'm on a homophobia break, so I'm just gonna like experience racism right now," or like, "I'm gonna just press pause on the racism so I can deal with the homophobia." And I often think that, you know, the homophobia and racism, they are inflected in each other. So a lot of the racism I experienced was also sort of tinged with a little bit of homophobia, where like people's racist expectations of black male masculinity was somehow also thwarted by my queerness, or like their expectation of like queerness was thwarted by my race or my class of origin growing up, you know, quite working class. And so I think that both racism and homophobia work by you know, people, by limiting people's understanding of your humanity and their ability to perceive you as like a fully realized human. And so I think that they work by limiting that. And that certainly, I think, comes up again and again for Wallace, where people are like, oh, but I've accepted your queerness. How could I possibly be racist? And then they go and say something quite racist to him at dinner. Or they think, oh, but I'm not racist. How could I possibly be homophobic? And then they say something incredibly awful. And so I think for me, you know, I've experienced them quite often, like, together, often one leading to the other.
Mm-hmm. You sort of alluded to this, somebody saying something, you know, nasty at a dinner party. So there's this dinner party scene, and I'm not going to give a whole lot of it away, but one of the characters says something pretty darn racist to Wallace, and the other people at the table, who are all white, kind of just like, you know, they don't come to his defense or say anything really. And you bring up this thing about silence and laughter is their way of getting by. And then later, one of the characters, Wallace thinks about her, she's nice, but in the way that white people are nice right before they perform some role in the secret machine that ruins black people's lives. And it made me kind of wonder if, is it hopeless that white people will ever really understand?
I don't think it's hopeless. I mean, I think that, and I don't think it's hopeless because I feel like when I was younger, I didn't understand the full extent of racism, or I didn't fully understand race. And I had internalized a lot of like negative and anti-black sentiments. And I'm a black person. And I came to greater awareness because I did the work to learn and to think and to sort of unpack a lot of the received notions that I'd gotten from the larger culture or whatever. And so I don't think it's hopeless. I think that what it takes is ultimately what it always takes for anything, which is to do the work to unpack our received ideas about other people and to make the conscious choice to work against those received notions and to always view that person as a person first and foremost, and to ask yourself, oh, I have assumptions about this person that are not predicated on anything I know about them except their race or their class or their sort of presenting gender or all these other things. Why do I have those notions? Where do they come from, and how can I work against them? And so I don't think it's hopeless, because I don't think that people are born, I don't think that we're born sort of flawed in this way. I think that we start in states of ignorance and we move hopefully towards states of knowing. And that has certainly been my experience. And, you know, that's not saying that, like, I'm not even calling on the example of like white people who I've seen educate themselves. Like, personally speaking for myself as a person who used to have anti-black sentiments for a whole host of reasons, and as someone who has worked really hard to divest myself from those sentiments, like, that is, I absolutely believe in the transformative power of unpacking our received notions. And I think that it's something that we as a society can do and we should do, hopefully.
Yeah. Okay, good. I mean, that's true. It's like unpacking our own internalized homophobia is certainly part of that whole thing. It comes, we don't even realize we have it until we look at it more deeply.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
And it seems like, I'm just curious, I mean, like I said, I haven't finished the book yet, but it seems that Wallace, the character Wallace, on the surface, the things he talks about, he seems to be more affected by racism, but deep down, maybe, you know, equally or perhaps even more by homophobia and the self-hatred that he experienced as a child and growing up, maybe perhaps by church, as parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that it's, you know, it's really, you're fighting it. I think it's really about the active front in your war, that the war the world is waging on you. Like, I think that Wallace moving to the Midwest, he's suddenly around people who have all these great progressive values, re-sexuality, right? Like, he's among social liberals. They're like, oh, I know gay people. Like, his social group is very queer. He knows all these gay people. And so he doesn't feel that his sexuality is necessarily an active front for that war against the world, but he is receiving like these racial microaggressions at a sort of really constant clip. Versus when he was a young child and living at home among his black family, his race wasn't an active front of that war, but his sexuality and his gender and whatever was. And so, you know, he's really, I think we're all fighting Well, the world is waging a war on us constantly on multiple fronts. It's just that the active front shifts from time to time, depending on your context. But really, all those things are happening simultaneously. And so I think it's absolutely true that the race takes up the bulk of his focus because that is the active front right then and there. But in his deeper core self, there are all of these unresolved wounds about that he got from family and from home that he's only just now beginning to grapple with. And so it's really that dual work of like the external stuff and also the deeply painful interior stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. I notice you're wearing your Filthy Animals sweatshirt there. So that's a great segue. That's your project you're working on now. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Filthy Animals is a linked short story collection. It comes out in June, very exciting, from Riverhead Books. And, you know, it's a book that's similar to real life in some ways in that it the stories at the heart of the book follow this young man, Lionel, who is a queer Black man in the Midwest, except Lionel is from the Midwest, so, you know, he doesn't have any weird Southern dissonance. And he meets a couple of dancers at a potluck one winter evening, and the stories sort of follow their trajectory as they become involved with each other. And it's, you know, and then there are these interstitial stories that aren't linked narratively, but are thematically. And to me, it's a book all about like desire and intimacy and wanting and lust and love and caregiving and mental illness, and all sort of explored through the lens of various short stories.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yeah. Very exciting.
Yeah. That looks fun. I'll look forward to that. There's a question my producer asked. What have people not asked you about real life that you wish they would in all these interviews you've had?
Oh, I mean, you know, at first I was always like, oh, no one asks me about the craft of the book. They only want to talk about my traumatic past. But I have been asked really lovely questions about the craft lately. So I feel like we've covered all the stuff. Because like, I think it is like structurally and quite a weird book. Like it also has these different tenses and it's doing weird stuff with time. But yeah, I mean, I feel like I've only been asked really thoughtful and wonderful questions about the book. So I'm quite happy with the questions.
And how has it been to be doing a book promotion during, you know, COVID shutdown?
Strange, but you know, I consider myself a very flexible person. It's been strange, but it's also been a lot of fun because I've gotten to do things that I might not have gotten to do otherwise. You know, like I've gotten to talk to writers who I might not have otherwise gotten to talk to, and I've gotten to do events in cities that I've never been, well, digitally in cities. And so it's, I don't know, it's been really lovely in a way. I feel like it's you know, some avenues have closed, but others have opened up in a really lovely way. So it's been, you know, strange, but fine.
Great. Well, Brandon, it's been really, really nice to meet you. And I'm sorry, our time is up already. I can't believe a half an hour has flown by so quickly. Thank you so much for taking some time with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a blast.
Great. You've been listening to Out in the Bay. My guest is Brandon Taylor, author of Real Life, his highly praised debut novel. To learn more about Brandon, check out our website, outinthebay.org, where we'll post links about Brandon, Real Life, and his other works. That's outinthebay.org, where you can also hear this show and past shows and share them with friends and sign up for our weekly email newsletter and subscribe to Out in the Bay via Stitcher and Apple Podcasts. That's outinthebay.org. While you're there, please consider making a donation. This month is especially important as we have the opportunity to receive $2,000 from an anonymous donor, but to receive this gift, we'll need your help to raise another $2,000 by the end of this year. So please consider investing in Queer Air coming to your ears. That's outinthebay.org. Just hit the donate button there. Kendra Klang produced this edition. Thank you, Kendra. Thanks also to co-producer Chu Quinn and to Holly Mead, who wrote and performed our theme music. We'd love to hear your comments. Please send comments, questions, and show suggestions to outinthebaysf@gmail.com. That's outinthebaysf@gmail.com. You could also write to us if you're interested in joining our program team. That email address again, outinthebaysf@gmail.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for joining us out in the Bay.